Great. Thank you very much. So yeah, I would like to first thank you all for having me here today, listening to me today. Especially, I would like to thank Juan and Niyayish for organizing this talk. I mean, going through all the difficulties of the organization. Unfortunately, I couldn't visit Perimeter because of visa matters, but I'm still glad that the post-COVID world has made us these type of interactions easier for us scientists. And I hope that we can have great discussions during the talk and also after the talk. There's just one problem that I can hear myself, I think.
We can hear you.
No, I can hear like myself through your microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
So I turned off the microphone, it should be good now.
Okay, yeah, let's give it a try then. So please interrupt me whenever you have questions. I hope that we can have great discussions during the talk and also after the talk, although I couldn't visit in person. So today I would like to tell you a bit about gravitational wave probes of extreme gravity, but of course, mostly focusing on the areas that I have personally worked on. Let me see if this works. Yes. So before going to the through the outline of my talk, I would like to start by quickly mentioning why we care about testing gravity. So we all know that general relativity is exceptionally successful in describing the weak gravity limit, but there are also good reasons, both from the observational side and also from theoretical side, to think that either something must be missing in our formulation of the theories, or that the current formulation of the general relativity is just limited. For instance, on the observational side, we have two main stories. One is the fact that the observed galaxy velocity curves do not really match with the predictions of general relativity, which then suggests that there must be some sort of extra gravity in these in spiral galaxies, and therefore we expect to have some sort of dark matter. Now, the other story is that distant supernovas seem to be located further than what we expected from basic general relativity, which then suggested the accelerated expansion of the universe, I think back in 1998. And this itself suggests that there should be some sort of a repulsive force, or let's say even a dark energy component that we haven't observed yet. So these observations may be possibly linked to the nature of gravity, or that, as suggested here, they might actually be associated to having some new unobserved elements, or maybe even both. And then there is also the theoretical side. So the list here is kind of more comprehensive, but of course, most of these issues may be linked to one another in some ways. For instance, we all know that general relativity is incompatible with quantum mechanics, and that there are no well-defined description of the theory at high energies, meaning that the theory might not have a UV completion. And these type of issues suggest that general relativity might be a leading order manifestation of a more fundamental theory, or just other theoretical scenarios. And on the other side, general relativity predicts singularities. So this is not a severe issue like the ones that I just explained, but this tells us that at some scales, the theory is just not predictable anymore. And this is usually what we don't like in physics. So then the question is to really see how we can get as close as possible to these strong field regimes of gravity, and in what ways we can test gravity at these regimes. So with these in mind, I would like to discuss a bit on the gravitational wave aspects of testing gravity. My talk would be sort of divided into two parts. The first part will be focused on a theory-specific test of gravity, Here I will tell you about what this theory is, why we care about it, and how gravitational waves enable us to probe the predictions of this theory. And I will also present results on analytical modeling of waveforms for this theory. Just a quick note, I'm not including my recent work on numerical aspects here, numerical aspects of this theory, but I'm more than happy to discuss further if there are any interests or if there are any questions arising during the talk. Now, in the second part, I would like to focus on gravitational wave tests of cosmology, the well-known standard Sirens approach. Here, I will explain the findings of one specific methodology for constraining Hubble constant by looking at the observations of neutron star black hole systems. But I will get back to this later on during the talk. So for now, let's see how we can actually go beyond general relativity while staying consistent with observations at the weak field limit. So GR is actually the unique outcome of one specific theory, the so-called Lovelock theory, which states that the Einstein tensor is the only rank two tensor that obeys all of the features that this theory has. So basically being built from a metric, being diffeomorphism invariant, symmetric, and divergence free. So by violating one of these assumptions or more than one of these assumptions, we can naturally arrive at different descriptions of gravity. For instance, as you can see, some of them on the figure here. Now, among all of these theories, I would like to focus on the so-called scalar Gauss-Bonnet theory, which lies basically in this category here. So there is an extra dynamical scalar field present. And it can be shown that this theory is a subclass of both quadratic gravity and the famous Hornetsky gravity. Now, let's take a look at the action of scalar Gauss-Bonnet gravity. So we can see the Einstein-Hilbert term here, and then the non-minimal coupling to a dynamical scalar field, phi, and also this specific combination of higher curvature terms, higher curvature correction terms to the action, which is called the Gauss-Bonnet scalar. Now, this theory is being extensively studied nowadays, and I would say that the main reason for this interest is that this theory is kind of simple, but still it shows to be a well-behaved extension to general relativity at a strong field limit. For instance, if we look at the field equations, we can find out that the field equations are at most second order in derivatives. There are no ghost instabilities present, and also that it has recently been shown that the theory has a well-posed initial value problem, which is actually crucial for getting a stable and fully nonlinear numerical simulations for this theory. Also, on a more fundamental level, I would say, this theory arises as the low energy limit to some specific formulations of string theory, but I'm not going to go into the details of that. But even apart from that, it is also motivated from an effective field theory point of view, effective field theory of gravity. Now, what makes this theory a promising candidate for gravitational wave tests specifically is mainly the fact that the black holes have testable features in this theory, the black holes solutions from this theory. So for instance, the theory can violate the Noether theorem. As a result of that, the black holes would get the so-called Hare parameter, which I have defined here, given the matter action. But you can also have dynamical or spontaneous scalarization of the black holes once they appear in a binary system. And also, most importantly, having this monopole scalar hair gives rise to dipolar scalar radiation, which is completely absent in general relativity. And all of these depend on different forms for the coupling function in this action. For instance, the linear and the exponential coupling would only acquire hairy black hole solutions, but the quadratic coupling or the Gaussian coupling would also have general relativity black holes as valid solutions, but these are the solutions that can then get spontaneously scalarized. So in summary, I would say that all of these different scenarios, different black hole space times would change. They would basically change the space time around the single black holes, something that might be testable with other probes like the Event Horizon telescope, let's say. But this has been, and all of these different solutions have been studied a lot in the literature, as you can see, but there are still ongoing efforts for finding a closed form for analytical solutions and also enhanced numerical solutions. And then what happens is that these modified spacetimes would change the dynamics once they appear in the binary systems, of course. So they would basically put imprints on their gravitational waveforms that we observe from these systems. So there has also been a lot of works on this area. So following the well-posedness work that I just mentioned, there has been a great improvement in the numerical simulations, both for the scalar radiation and also the gravitational waves, especially in the weak coupling limits. But on the analytical side of these waveforms, for a long time, we only relied on the waveforms to the Newtonian order. And actually, this is the direction which we have advanced now in our recent work, which together with the numerical relativity waveforms should bring us one step closer to basically building full waveform templates for this theory and then test it completely with the gravitational wave data. So let me explain a bit what this analytical work is about. So these analytical waveforms are built upon the assumption of having weak fields and low velocities, what is also called the post-Newtonian approximation. Therefore, these waveforms are valid at the in-spiral stage of the binary dynamics. And it's like this, that once you solve the field equations with these assumptions of weak field and low velocities, the waveforms, to the lowest order in these perturbation scheme, the waveforms are identical to general relativity. Now, what we have done is that by going to first post-Newtonian order, we now have incorporated the effect of the higher curvature terms, the Gauss-Bonnet invariant term, inside the gravitational waveforms. So those nonlinear curvature terms that you saw in the action, they basically start to show effects from one post-Newtonian order and higher, sorry. And having these terms included in the waveform, this basically allows us to systematically study possible deviations from GR that come from these higher curvature terms and not just the scalar dynamics, so the dipole scalar radiation that I mentioned earlier. So it's basically an essential first step for building waveform templates for this theory. So for the conciseness, I would like to move forward, and I don't want to go through the details behind the post-Newtonian calculation because it gets very technical, but I'm happy to discuss this further if anyone is interested in knowing about it. I just want to make a quick note on the first steps for these calculations because it's useful for the rest of the discussion. So as I said, this post-Newtonian calculations are a perturbative scheme. So once you start with the field equations and write them down in a, let's say, a good gauge, you can write them down in this wave-like equations. And then your expansion in terms of weak fields would look something like this. So all of these red terms come from the expansion of the Gauss-Bonnet curvature term. And this pink and this green term comes from the matter action, basically. So you would have the metric, so you would have the metric perturbation and the scalar perturbation. And the situation is something that at the zeroth order, you have your GR black hole background, and that would source your scalar field perturbation, basically. And then the scalar field perturbation together with the background metric would basically source the metric perturbations that you have here. So the point that I want to make here is that in the cases where this derivative of the matter action vanishes, so basically in the cases where you don't have a scalar hair or scalarization, all these contributions to the tensor perturbation also vanishes because it acts as a source here. So you would get general relativity back. And that's how this hair parameter basically enters through these calculations here. But then the rest is just the technicalities of how to take, how to get these integrals and to arrive at the waveform templates. As I said, I would be happy to discuss further later on. Now, but let's look at some results here. So here is one example of these waveforms showing the basically the time evolution of the waveforms and also the frequency evolution of the waves. The blue curve shows the scalar Gauss-Bonnet waveform, and the black one is the general relativity counterpart to that. And these different colors that you see on top here, these are the different snapshots of these waveforms. Basically, they show different time frames. So as we can see here, the dephasing between the GR and the scalar Gauss-Bonnet waveforms start very early in the dynamics, like as soon as these waveforms enter the detector band, basically. The minimum frequency here is considered to be 10 hertz. So it basically shows that if we really manage to observe long gravitational wave in spirals, then the accumulated effect of this dephasing should be detectable, basically. But I also want to stress that the last snapshot, so basically the pink one here, this is not an accurate description of these waveforms because the post-Newtonian approximation is not valid at this stage. So this is just a schematic view of the differences, but we shouldn't really conclude anything about this huge amplitude differences that we see here. So we should really focus more on the in-spiral stage. But the effect that we see here, which is showing an accelerated merger, this is overall an expected effect because, as I said, these systems also radiate away a scalar energy, so they are kind of more dissipative as compared to general relativity waveforms. Now, let's see how we can use these waveforms. So one of the areas where these analytical waveforms are useful is actually in the in-spiral tests of gravity, which are based on parameterized modifications to the background general relativity waveform. So basically you add parameterized modifications at each different post-Newtonian order, assuming that you have GR phasing and GR amplitude. And then when you have analytical waveforms in other theories of gravity, let's say, as we have here, the scalar Gauss-Bonnet gravity, what you can do is that you can map the constraints on these parameters to the unknown parameter of your theory, which here is the coupling parameter. Now, here you can see the results of one of these mappings. This is using mock data, not the real gravitational wave data. Here they have used both the leading order waveforms, so the Newtonian order waveforms, and also the recent one post-Newtonian order waveforms, so the full 1PN waveforms. The red curve is the Newtonian order waveform, and the green curve is all of the new terms added to the Newtonian waveforms. So we can already see a somewhat factor of two improvement in the constraints on the coupling parameter, or I should better say that we kind of expect a factor of two improvement in the constraints. But more important is the threshold that, as we can see, it's kind of shifting more towards lower couplings, and we can, by using these waveforms, we can basically rule out coupling constants that are higher than 2.5 parameters. I see that there is a raised hand.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to continue, it's fine. But I was just wondering if you knew the black and the blue curves, they seem to exclude zero?
Yes. No, that's so the black and blue curves here are not specific to the Skinner-Gauss-Bonnet theory. They're just they basically come from the mathematical structure of this parameterized tests, which is called the PPE formalism. So they're not related to the bounds on the Gauss-Bonnet term. If I want to be more specific, they basically show that if you assume generic terms, generic parameters at these different PN orders in this parameterized test, then this is something that you would expect. But with the in spiral waveforms, we now have the actual mapping to the Gauss-Bonnet terms, and this would basically be the bounds. But that's basically just coming from the mathematical side of their study.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is just out of curiosity, or maybe trying to get myself informed. So as you pointed out earlier, indeed there is this work by Real and Kovacs that established well poisonous, but what is often lost in the final fine print of that paper is that is up to some value of the coupling parameter and assuming the long wavelength regime and everything stays there. If not, that well poisonous result goes out of the window. So yeah. As one goes and tries to do this Positonian, here you're varying alpha, so you're varying that scale. Where would I see, or at what order would that problem arise, which we know arises thanks to the work by, in particular, say, Max and Will here that do see that breaking, and others as well. So how far in PN would you have to go before you actually see that?
I see. So the thing about the PN calculations is that you can continue all the calculations without assuming any bounds on the alpha. So basically from the mathematical, sorry, let me just reduce my volume so that I don't hear myself. So from the mathematical expansions or the mathematical treatment of the PN theory, you don't really need to put any bounds on the coupling. You can just do the expansion and just keep track of the weak field and the low velocity expansion parameters. So in principle, you wouldn't really get into any problems mathematically. But then the problem is that once you start to make these plots and then to compare them with the actual waveforms, that is really where you would start to see whether things make sense or not. But
that's precisely the point that confuses me, because I could imagine the system be in arbitrarily slow velocities. I can think of nothing else going on except that my scatter field now explores high enough frequency, and mm-hmm. I will break everything. So if no PN order kind of captures that, wouldn't that call into question the PN approach to begin, apply in this case to begin with? That's where I get confused.
Mm-hmm. I see. No, I wouldn't say that it would. It would be in conflict with the PN expansion, because the PN expansion is just, I would say it's another type of expansion. So you don't really need to assume anything about the coupling, but so you can just keep going with the calculations. Or what I'm trying to say is that the structure of the terms that you get, they wouldn't really change if you make the small coupling assumption or not. It's just that the scaling might differ, or the apparent scaling of the PN terms might differ, but it doesn't destroy the calculations. So you would still have the same terms. Let's look at this, for instance. You would still have the same sort of terms. It's just that you might say that, okay, within this coupling regime, this acts like a hierarchical term, or this acts like a subdominal term. The real problem comes in where you actually start to compare these waveforms with numerical relativity waves, or with the GR waves, I would say. And there you have to really make wiser choices. But I would say that the PN calculation alone cannot tell you which range of the coupling parameters are valid or should be valid. It's just a mathematical structure that can, that, and this is really like a free parameters. Alpha is really like a free parameter here.
So I wonder if I could ask a maybe related question. So in the input to the PN calculation, are you already inputting, like, for example, what the scalar charge of a black hole of a given mass and coupling would be? Or is that something that you're calculating within PN?
Right. No, so that's the thing. So with the PN, you can just start generically. You just do a weak field expansion. So you only assume this. And then the low velocity approximation. And the low velocity approximation only helps you to deal with these integrals, basically. So you want to solve these complicated integrals that have the expanded source terms here. And this low velocity just helps you to break these down and use different approximations to go through them. But throughout the calculations, until you really reach the endpoint of these expressions, you are just considering this alpha, the coupling constant parameter, and also the hair parameter as generic. And then once you want to compare the waveforms or make the plots, then yes, then you should make reasonable choices for what values these parameters can take. But yeah, I mean, in these calculations, we didn't start from assuming anything about the value of the hair parameter or the value of the coupling parameter or anything.
Right. So then on the next slide, when you made those plots of the PN results, then you took as input like what the exact stationary black hole solutions were and what their hair was? Or
yes,
put that as an input to the PN parameter?
Yeah, as the input, you would basically need all the parameters that you see here. You would need the masses. You would need the masses. You would need, let's see, the scalar charge parameter and the coupling constant. But there are studies which have calculated this coupling parameter as a function. Sorry, they have calculated the hair parameter as a function of the coupling. So in the end, all the new parameters that you have, apart from the masses of the black holes, would be the coupling parameter. Because these parameters, the S plus, S minus, and so on, they all depend on the hair parameter, and the hair parameter itself depends on alpha. It's like a perturbative expansion in terms of alpha. And then we have made this plot for different values of alpha. I mean, that would basically be the point where your assumptions about the coupling enter. And then depending on how large or how small you choose the value, you would either get reasonable waveforms or something that is totally off.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just to clarify for me, the formula you have for HIJ, that's what translates into the dephasing of the waveform, or is it separate constraint? Is it coming just from this, or?
No, this is it's not separate. So with the post-Newtonian approximation, you solve for the waveforms, but you also solve the acceleration. And then from the acceleration, you solve the Kepler's law, which is the modified Kepler's law. So you also have like frequency as a function of distance of the two objects. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have both the waveforms and, let's say, the frequency as a function of R, and then you can solve the phasing. So they're just different equations, different physical equations of your system.
The thing that I'm, I guess, asking is a follow-up on the previous. How much of it is specific to assuming this particular modification versus mm-hmm. just adding, as you say, a free parameter to like do the PPN.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, everything comes from your action. So yeah, that would basically be this part. So once you expand your field equations and you arrive to the expansion in terms of vfield, and then you want to split these, you have to basically solve these integrals. But the thing is that depending on your distance from the source, like you have a binary source, which is like here, and this is like the observer, let's say, depending on that, you would use different approximations for solving these integrals. So you would kind of solve for two different sets of integrals. One is called the near zone integrals, which gives you potentials, like let's say Newtonian potential. And then the other one is far zone, which is the waveforms. So once you have solved for this and that, all of them just coming from the field equations, you would basically have access to both the phasing and the waveforms, or let's say the acceleration and the waveforms.
So you're saying it's very specific. It's not necessarily a generic feature of any modified gravity necessarily that I would.
No, I wouldn't say it's generic to any modified. Yeah, it really depends on how these perturbations would go and how they would show themselves. Yeah, in the integrals, in the weak field.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? All right, then I will continue. Yes, so that's basically where these in spiral waveforms, I would say, can be most useful. At least we can use them to put some bounds on the value of the coupling parameter. But of course, these studies also have some limitations. I mean, the mapping of parameterized tests to specific tests, they also have some difficulties on their own. Now, I would like to go a few steps back to the waveform calculations again, and talk about another distinct effect that also arises in these scalar Gauss-Bonnet binary systems, binary black hole systems. So I already mentioned that the black holes in this theory have a monopole scalar charge. Now, interestingly, they can also have tidal deformations, like the neutron star tidal deformations in GR. And this is basically, this tidal deformation is basically the response of one of these black holes to the scalar field perturbation of the other body, of the companion body. Now, this is called the scalar type tidal deformability, which is different from the tensor tidal deformability that we are familiar with in general relativity, as I said, but it's kind of the same thing. I mean, the mathematics is kind of the same. It's just the perturbations of the scalar field. And it is a finite size effect that once we include it in the matter action, it will further distinguish these black holes from the black holes in general relativity. So this is a work which I have been doing with one of the master's students that I've supervised. She's also a PhD student now in Utrecht. So what we have done is that we have explicitly derived this tidal deformability parameter, the scalar tidal deformability parameter, assuming a small coupling approximation. So basically the same approach that people take once they want to solve for black hole solutions. And importantly, we have now included this additional effect in the tidal, in the dynamics and also in the waveform template of this scalar Gauss-Bonnet theory. And we have also found that these tidal induced terms, they also arise at the one post-Newtonian order. So this is kind of interesting because it basically tells us that they have the same scaling as the Gauss-Bonnet curvature terms. So we should kind of study their effects together if you want to, let's say, map them to these parameterized tests. So this plot shows the comparison between the scalar tidal effects, I've called this E lambda, and the Gauss-Bonnet higher curvature terms for a variety of different binary configurations. So different total masses and different mass ratios. Now this, and so based, so these counter lines are the ratio between the binding energy contributions, the Gauss-Bonnet binding energy and the tidal deformation binding energy. And what we can see is basically, as we can see, it's a comparable kind of effect for a broad range of binary configurations. So as I said, yeah, basically the important message here is that including these effects in the waveforms might actually affect the inferred bounds on the coupling constant, but in a good way. I mean, it should in principle put tighter constraints on the coupling, but we haven't done this study ourselves yet. I mean, we are just working on the waveforms at the moment. And the last point that I want to make here, which is also in connection to the work of the group here at Perimeter, is that we do still need more accurate analytical waveforms if we want to build full in-spiral merger ring-down waveforms. So if you really want to match these in-spiral waveforms to numerical relativity waves. Now, I would say these waveforms are good enough for in-spiral tests because if we go to higher post-Newtonian orders, we don't really expect to see way better constraints on the coupling, just because of the nature of the PN calculation, that it's just the perturbative expansion. But for building actual waveform templates, we do need to have more accurate PN waveforms. So if there are no questions on this part of my talk, I would like to shift to the next part. But just
I just had a quick question on your last slide. So, yes. So you're saying that, like you're describing this one PN correction to the binding energy. So, at what order does that affect the gravitational waveform?
Or it's also one, yeah. So I haven't showed the gravitational waves here. I'm just showing the binding energy, but we have done the calculations to one PN, and we saw that these terms are arising, so they don't vanish at 1 p.m. And the leading order effect is 1 p.m. So all of the calculations are being done at 1 p.m. But as we can see here, for some systems, they're just subdominal as compared to Gauss-Bonnet ones. And for some other systems, they're comparable. It's just that they have the same scaling with V over C, let's say, or with 1 over R.
Right. I guess I just confused, like, so on your previous slide, you said that you were, you know, basically including all the, or one slide further back, that you're including all the 1 PN terms, right? Or, so could you say a little bit about to the extent to which in this calculation there are effects that are not included at 1 PN or lower order?
I see. So this is a study done by this group. What I was trying to say is that here for this study, they have used the analytical waveforms that we computed for the Gauss-Bonnet terms. So analytical waveforms that we found by starting from this action here. So we took this action, the main effects were coming from this higher curvature terms. And for the matter action, we just assumed the point particle limit for the black holes. So no tidal interactions or no tidal corrections or finite size corrections to the action. So this is what we have done, and we have the paper on that. And this is study here, just let me go to the slide. This is study here relies on those waveforms, relies on mapping those waveforms to these parameterized tests. But what we are now working on is that we are extending the matter action with this tidal interaction term. So we are basically including this finite size term in the description of the black holes. And it could have been that these terms would have entered at higher PN order, but they have started to contribute at 1 PN order. So in principle, they would basically affect those calculations. I mean, they wouldn't change anything. They would just be as extension or more corrections to those calculations at 1 PM. But I just wanted to add that in any case, this is a subdominal effect because it is a finite size correction to the point particle limits of the black hole. So it shouldn't be as large as the main effect of having just a scalar dependent mass. I see there is a hand raised.
Yeah, Hassan.
Thank you, Banafshe. So I have a question. I hope Max is also hearing me. So I saw when Max was talking about their new paper, so she was showing some plots that even up to 2 PN, so correct me if I misunderstood that, up to 2 PN, it was not enough for, especially when you were increasing your coupling parameter. But here, the plot for the probability that you showed, so yes. So here, they're going, I mean, up to very larger alphas, but still they are only considering here, I mean, you're just showing up to 1 PN, the green one, right? So I just, I'm just a little bit confused if you could, or guys in PI there could explain what's the relation between these and that. If up to 2 PN is not even enough, so what can we conclude from here, which is only up to 1 PM?
Okay, I will give my answer, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the audience. The thing is that there are two separate, I mean, I would look at them as two separate things. One is the mapping of the waveforms to whatever the order you have to the tests, to the parameterized tests of gravity. And for that, you can take any order of the waveforms that you have. So you get the waveform, let's say, to 1 PN, you compare it with this, with the bounds on, with this, let's say, waveforms, with this parameterized waveforms, and then you translate the bounds on these parameters to a bound on your coupling. That's something that you can do at any PN order. At any order that you have the waveforms, you can, for instance, just stick with the Newtonian order waveforms, but you're just missing some modifications. You're missing some information that might actually help you to get better constraints. But there is nothing that wrong with it, I would say. The problem, the 2 PN problem that you mentioned, that basically arises where you want to match the waveforms with numerical relativity waveforms. So that's another thing. So if you want to build a full waveform, the accuracy of the PN waveform at 1 PN is just not enough to be able to do the matching. I can roughly say that the PN order, although I am plotting this PN waveform up way to the merger, I would say that the PN order is just valid up to like these part, like this regime, let's say, like, I don't know, like 65 seconds after it enters the detector band. So, or let's say, I mean, I don't know the exact number, but something around like, I don't know, 60 orbits before the merger, or even way before that. So 30 orbits before the merger. So if we really, but the numerical relativity waveforms, they are valid. I mean, you can get numerical relativity waveforms like up to 8 or 16 or 20 cycles before the merger. So you still need something in that area. You need higher PN orders in order to be able to get accurate waveforms until you reach your numerical waves. But please go ahead. I mean, if Max is there or Lewis, that they want to add anything on this, please, please go ahead.
Hi, so it's not Lewis, no Max. But, but I just have a question comment on this PN order thing. For example, in your slide, you compare with GR3PN here. And for me, it's related that you need to go to 3PN because actually when you say that your correction, either for the Bosboné term or the tidal term is 1PN, it's 1PN, but because you have a dimension full coupling parameter. So if you could replace this by a dimensionless parameter, then you will see that it will appear as a 3PN correction in the waveform.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't know what is the question, but is it like, for me, I think it should be, I understand that the correction may be enhanced, but formally it's a 3PN correction instead of 1PN. So you should include all the 3PN waveform to compare with.
I see. Yes, so let me again reduce my volume. So yeah, this, I had a very long discussion about this with Nico as well, Nico Yunus from Illinois. And the thing is that it is true from some sense. The fact is that the reason why I call it 1PN is that if you just do it, if you look at everything from a mathematical point of view, you're really perturbing everything, or you're really doing the expansion at 1PN order. And these terms or these expressions that I'm showing here, so basically waveform as a function of R, the separation, they are still showing you 1PN scaling. Now, the conversion or let's say the appearance as a 3PN term enters once you start to basically write this coupling parameter. Once you start to transfer these equations in terms of frequency, and also once you start to basically rewrite this coupling parameter in a dimensionless form. So that's basically where you would see that, oh, actually, I've done my calculation to 1PN, but the scaling is appearing as a 3PN. But I would actually agree with you that if we want to really have a precise comparison, we should include all the terms up to 3PN. But this basically means that, we have to do these expansions at 3PN as well. We cannot just rely on GR 3PN terms and then add this Gauss-Bonnet term on top of it and say, okay, now we have a full 3PN calculation there. But that was my short answer to this. We can also discuss further in detail because, yeah, we had a long discussion on this as well.
I think you should move to cosmology now.
Perfect. All right. Let me reduce the volume again. So, right. So now I want to shift to the second topic. So in the remaining time, I would like to touch upon another powerful, I would say, aspect of gravitational waves, which enables us to, probe cosmology. So in the beginning of my talk, I briefly mentioned that the nature of the accelerated expansion of the universe is still unknown. But the problem is even worse than that, because different observations do not even agree on the rate of this expansion. Now, these are the many different sort of recent observations, all showing Hubble constant values that range from 64 to, 80. The two most important ones are the CMB constraints from the early universe and the supernova distant ladder constraints of the Schustein from the high redshift universe. So basically the gray and the blue shaded regions here. And the overall discrepancy between these two observations at the moment is at the level of 4 sigma. But these observations also have different assumptions. So the distance ladder method, it's a relative measure, it needs anchoring, and the CMB measure is model dependent. So each of them have just different assumptions behind them. But gravitational wave observations from compact mergers can be a completely separate measure for cosmology, because these systems give you absolute measure, direct measure of the luminosity distance. In contrast to, for instance, the supernova distance ladder method that I just mentioned. So even if we assume the simplest form for the waveforms, what we have is that the phasing of the gravitational waves gives us the redshifted masses or the redshifted chirp mass. And then from the amplitude of the gravitational waves, we have this combination of the redshifted chirp mass and the distance, the luminosity distance. So from the gravitational waves, we have direct access to the luminosity distance. And then if we be able to measure or estimate redshifts in some ways, then we would be able to measure cosmological parameters. Now, so the thing is that, as I said, we need to measure redshift somehow, and this usually requires extra input, I would say, from other methods or other observations, like having electromagnetic counterpart observations for some of the systems, or relying on galaxy catalogs and many other techniques that are being developed nowadays. But still, the most preferable option is to have some sort of an electromagnetic counterpart, because it still gives us the most precise and accurate way of pinning down the redshift, like having very tightly constrained redshift measurements. Like, this plot alone from the latest LVK results can show us how much more powerful this one event, the GW170817 event, which had an electromagnetic counterpart, it can show us how much more powerful this event is as compared to the other measures which use binary black hole systems observed by LVK. Now, what I want to specifically focus on in the rest of the talk is an approach which allows us to measure the cosmological parameters with gravitational waves by only relying on gravitational wave data. So no need for electromagnetic counterparts or using galaxy catalogs or any other, as I said, extra input. Now, the idea behind this approach was already known since 2011, with the work of Messenger and Reed. And it basically relies on having neutron stars in the merger. So basically having matter effects in your waveforms. So let me just be a bit more specific. So if you look at the waveforms from binary black hole mergers, the features of these waveforms are totally degenerate with the redshifts, something like this. So a change in the redshift would only rescale your overall binary black hole waveform. Now, once you have neutron stars in your binary, the matter effects, basically these tidal deformations of the neutron star, these matter effects would break this redshift degeneracy. And the reason behind this is that the matter effects or this tidal deformability effects, they are a function of the source mass of the neutron star, like the physical mass of the neutron star. They're not a function of the redshifted masses that usually appear in the gravitational waveforms. So by having these matter effects, you can basically break this degeneracy, and then you would have access to the redshift of these events by looking at their gravitational waveforms as well. But then the problem here, or the difficulty here, would be to actually model these matter effects, because as we know, we generally don't know good enough information about the neutron star matter effects. But but before getting into how we can actually model these matter effects, let me first explain why neutron star black holes are interesting for this approach. So these systems are kind of, I would say, advantages because they are naturally detectable up to higher redshifts as compared to binary neutron star systems. And this is mainly because they just allow for higher total masses. So we have one black hole, one neutron star. It naturally has higher mass as compared to having two neutron stars. Now, the other reason is that these systems have sort of a distinct merger morphology as compared to binary neutron stars, which sometimes allows them to have highly disrupted events, highly tidally disrupted events. And then you can show that these disruptions would strongly affect the waveforms that you get from these systems. So depending on the mass of the black hole and the spin of the black hole, you can have two scenarios. You can either, the black hole can either, as I said, disrupt the neutron star, or it can, I would say, kind of eat the neutron star without disrupting it. Now, in the case of the disruptive mergers, we do expect electromagnetic counterparts. In the other case, we don't. And also the gravitational wave signals, the signatures of the signals are also totally different. For instance, they are either more tilted towards binary neutron star-like waveforms, which have no post-merger signal, in the disruptive case, or they are more tilted towards binary black hole-like signals, where you can also have a ring down stage. Now, here are some examples of these systems, different mass ratios, and their comparison to binary black hole signals. So here they show, as I said, these are different mass ratios. So what we can see here, for instance, is that there is a clear distinction in the waveform of the binary black hole case and the neutron star black hole case. In this Q equal 2 case, so the mass ratio of 2, which is a disruptive system. But more importantly, given that these disruptive systems have a small mass ratio, and that if we go to lower distances, all of these lines would basically get shifted to lower strains. Because of all of these, what we see is that the merger of these disruptive systems, or the merger of most of the neutron star black hole systems, hardly lies in the LIGO detector band frame, or LIGO-like detectors. So these enhanced matter effects in the waveforms can be used for cosmology, or can be probed with the next generation detectors, basically. So with the Einstein telescope and Cosmic Explorer detectors. And these are actually the detectors that we are going to focus on. I mean, we have focused on in this work as well. So yeah, so as I said, there are really two different things playing a role here. One is the merger being disruptive, and the other one is to actually have access to the merger stage with your detector. So let's see what we can get from analyzing these neutron star black hole systems. So as I said, to get the cosmological parameters, we need to model the unknown matter effects now. Usually this is done by either fixing the choice of the matter, neutron star matter equation of state, or by using some sort of a fitting formula which shows the relation between this tidal deformability parameter and the mass, something like a Taylor expansion of the lambda, the tidal deformability as a function of mass. These modelings have been used in various studies, but what we have done in our recent work is that we have only relied on empirical constraints. So we have used the latest constraints from the NICER X-ray observations on the neutron star mass and radius. The constraints come from these two orange regions, or these two pulsars that you see here. And so those constraints combined with the gravitational wave constraints coming from the LVKs, from the GW170817, the gravitational wave constraints on the lambda. So the green region here. So the pink curves, the pink, let's say, equations of states here, and the overall blue shady region around it, all of this shows the region and the different equation of states, which are consistent with these joint constraints. So for our analysis, we have used over 3,000 choices of these equation of states. And for each of the different equation of choices, we have generated a different lambda as a function of mass relation, basically. And we have used these different relations throughout our Bayesian analysis, so throughout the sampling. So we are not putting a constant prior on lambda, or we are not making any other assumptions on fixing the lambda parameter and so on. Now, here you can see the results of this Bayesian inference for the estimation of tidal deformability. So from the left to right, we see systems of different mass ratios, so disruptive, from going from disruptive systems to non-disruptive systems. And also different colors show different black hole spins, but that doesn't, that's not that important here now. And the upper panel and lower panel show systems that are either merging in the detector frame band or outside of the detector frame band. So we either have access to the merger or that we don't. And what we can clearly see is that the cases on the upper panel are doing much better in constraining the lambda because, as I said, they merge within the sensitivity band of the detector. And but still, there is a very large difference between the disruptive systems and the non-disruptive ones. And the same goes for just comparing the disruptive systems here. So for instance, on the top panel, the disruptive systems that merge within the detector frame band can constrain lambda to 36% precision, which is quite accurate. But this number increases to 50%. This number increases to 95% for systems that are way further away and they merge outside of the detector band. And we can also see that in some cases, we don't even get any constraints. So we get like a completely uninformative posterior back on lambda. Now, let's just focus on the most optimistic cases. So the Q equal 2 and Q equal 6 of the in-band merger. So these are the full counterplots for these two cases. Here we can see the correlation between the parameters as well. But what is most evident is that the tight constraints on lambda that we just saw do not constrain redshift very considerably for having extremely precise Hubble constant measurement. I mean, the redshift constraints are good. It's very small, but the bounds are not extremely large. We already have good enough redshift estimation, but once you translate it to the bounds on the Hubble parameter, it's not very promising. So by looking at single events. Now, with this in mind, we also analyzed catalogs of neutron star black hole events. So instead of relying on one golden event, here we now have population of detectable neutron star black hole systems. The gray lines are single events by varying different parameters of the binary. And the blue lines in all of these cases are the combined posterior from from these single events. So as we can see, this clearly shows that, let's say with 100 neutron star black hole events, 100 neutron star black hole events is somewhat enough for precision measurement of the Hubble constant in the Einstein telescope and the Cosmic Explorer detector era. But just note that with these detectors, it is basically expected to observe up to 100 events in less than a day. So this 4% precision is really, I would say, achievable, even if we even if we consider way less optimistic settings for these population of neutron stars and so on. But the very, very important point to keep in mind here is that if we really want to reach this percent level precision, then systematic errors from the calibration of the waveforms and also systematic errors coming from the waveform models themselves, they would actually play a big role. And we should really put a lot of focus on improving those aspects before really concluding anything on these bounds here. And yeah, these basically should be studied in more details. So this brings me to the summary and the conclusions. So in this talk, I covered two areas related to the tests of gravity. I told you that scalar Gauss-Bonnet gravity is somewhat believed to be a well-behaved extension to general relativity up to some levels and some scales. And it has interesting and testable features like having hairy black holes, scalar-induced tidal deformations, and so on. Focusing on analytical waveforms, we now have the effect of the higher curvature terms in the waves, and also the scalar-induced tidal deformations. Now, this all brings us, I would say, one step closer to having full and spiral merger ring-down waveforms, given that we have also seen a lot of advances in the numerical relativity simulations. I also mentioned the direct application of these in spiral waveforms to the tests of gravity. So we can already put bounds on the coupling parameter by using these waveforms. And I would say that that is basically the most promising aspect that we can use these waveforms now. Now, in the second part, I mentioned a methodology with dark neutron star black hole standard sirens that allows us to test the background cosmology by only relying on gravitational wave observations. So I showed you that this approach relies on having matter effects in the waveforms, and that if you look at a catalog of neutron star black holes, then we can basically get a something of around 30% to 4% precision measurement of the Hubble constant with only one day of observation in the ETNC detector era. I also want to add that, as I said, the main source of uncertainty in this analysis has been the limitations of the waveform models. So what we saw for the single events that can actually be improved within the upcoming years, I would say, as soon as we have better neutron star black hole waveform models, the part that was on the single events can actually be improved way further. So yes, thank you very much for your attention. And yeah, I would like to stop here and please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, very nice talk. Sorry for many questions. Do we have more? Any more online? Thank you.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thanks very much for the interesting talk. I just had a quick question about essentially your last point. So the neutron star black hole population being able to deliver this, you know, say order 10% measurement of H0. How does this compare to doing the same kind of measurement with binary neutron star mergers in the 3G era, because I guess I would imagine that the most informative neutron star black hole mergers are the, you know, very loud nearby ones. And within that horizon, we will certainly be detecting many BNS mergers as well. So I'm just curious about the comparison.
I see. Yeah, I think the study on the neutron star black hole mergers is actually done by, I think I've mentioned it here, but yes, by Chatterjee et al. And as far as I can remember, they do show comparable bounds for these detectors. But the thing is that there are some differences between this study our study and their study, and the fact that I think there they were looking at separate 3G detectors, like Einstein telescope alone and then Cosmic Explorer alone. But in the end, I would say that, I mean, the difference is to say that, okay, one is 4%, one is 30%, one is 10%. So all the orders are, they're all at this order. It's just that binary neutron star system, I mean, sorry, neutron star black hole systems can really allow us to go to higher redshifts because they're just heavier and you would be able to measure them up to higher sensitivities. So you can really go way higher in these strain.
Right. So I guess what I'm asking is, are you actually getting considerable information about the tidal deformability from those really high redshift NSBH mergers?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some measure, you know, like what fraction of the information is actually contributed by those versus the nearby ones?
I see. Yeah, so that's the thing. So we haven't done like a concrete analysis of how much difference that would make. But just by looking at different scenarios, different single event scenarios at different distances, what we could really see was that if you have systems that merge within the detector frame band, so if you really have systems that this part of the waveform is actually inside the sensitivity, then you can get bounds on the tidal deformability. Even if they are really far away, like 1 gigaparsec here, as you can see, like this plot is not, I mean, it's not as promising as the 300 megaparsec event, but it's still, you are getting like good enough constraints on the lambda. It's just that when you have an outside of the band merger and also completely non-disruptive, then it's totally uninformative. But I don't know where the threshold is, like where this actually happens, because it also depends on the spin of the black holes. And with the current waveform models, we couldn't really study the effect of the spin very precisely.
Okay, thanks a lot.
First of all, thanks for the nice talk. So if I could just ask a follow-up to this. So, I mean, I guess you consider different equations of state here. Like, how sensitive is this, like, few percent number that you have on the little constant to that? Like, is there some, you know, mm-hmm. the neutron stars tend to be, like, on the small side, small radius side of what's mm-hmm. the allowed parameter space, then, and disruptions are very rare, then could that change a lot?
I see. Yes. As I said, we haven't fixed the equation of state. We are basically choosing from a really wide range of viable equation of states, which cover whatever these observations allow us to have. But we actually also studied the fixed equation of state choice, so where we basically just picked one equation of state, the most probable one, based on this specific posterior. And what we saw was that it does improve the bounds, but it doesn't change the bounds on the Hubble constant extremely. Like, it doesn't go from, let's say, 40 to 300 that we see here to, let's say, 60 to 80. It's not like that. It's really of the same, like, comparable effect. It's just that you would get better bounds on lambda and and the other parameters.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? If no, let's thank our speaker again. Okay. It's probably already very late in Europe. And,